Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, can a Christian thinker from many centuries ago speak with authority on contemporary marital relationships? Our guest will explain, and we are pleased to have philosopher Dr. Miguel Endara on the program today. First of all, greetings to you, Miguel. Welcome to Straight Thinking.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, Ken, and maybe by way of a long introduction here, we can explain, as we usually do, why we have somebody like Miguel on the program and what you hope to accomplish on this podcast.
Yeah, that's right, Joe. Miguel has had a long association with RTB, goes back a long time. I think he might have known Hugh Ross right before I met Hugh. But Miguel is not only a philosopher, we're pleased to have him as a visiting scholar. He's written a couple articles that I want to talk with him about. But I also want our listeners to get to know him a little bit. I'll bet some of you have seen Miguel's name. So Miguel, it's not only nice to have you as a visiting scholar, I'm really happy to have you on our program, Straight Thinking.
Thank you, Ken. It's my privilege to be on your program.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you came to connect with RTB. What was happening at that time and how long ago was that?
That was 1988. I was enrolled in Simon Greenleaf School of Law. They had an apologetics program, and I was in the apologetics program taking courses. And scientific apologetics sounded like an interesting course. At the time, I was working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I have an undergraduate degree in computer science, and I worked at JPL for 10 years.
Wow.
But so I had some scientific interests. And when I heard about this course, I decided to sign up for it. So that's where I met you.
Well, great. A lot of us kind of go back to Simon Greenleaf. I worked with Walter Martin at the Christian Research Institute, and Martin and John Warwick Montgomery, who founded the law school, Simon Greenleaf, were close friends. And so we all seem to have some connections back there, but I didn't know you worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Yeah, that kind of piqued my interest. When were you there and where did you work?
I was there from 1986 to 1996. I began as a software engineer, and then I started doing computer networking.
So what department were you in?
I began with in section 348. Like software department.
Yeah, the computer division or whatever it's called.
Yeah, it means something to you JPL guys, but 348 is just a number.
Well, Miguel, tell us a little bit about your studies in philosophy. Where did you go to school? Why did you pursue philosophy instead of more computer science?
Yes, of course. Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to begin at the beginning. When I became a Christian, when I was in college, and when I became a Christian, I started reading Christian books. I always liked to read. So I asked my friends, what kind of books should I read? So I started reading the books they suggested. But after a while, I found that I was almost exclusively attracted to books on apologetics. That's all I wanted to read. And I couldn't get enough of it. So when I, on the way back from work, from JPL, I would always listen to Walter Martin, the Bible Answer Man. And Walter Martin talked about Simon Greenleaf, Simon Greenleaf School of Law and School of Apologetics. So I decided to sign up there. So I started taking courses there, and I had the privilege of taking a course from, actually a couple courses from J.P. Moreland. And J.P. Moreland one time said to his students, if you want to be good apologists, you need to be philosophers. The way he put it is all roads lead to Rome. You need to take philosophy. So that's what I did. So that's how I got interested in philosophy. It was Walter Martin and then J.P. Moreland.
Well, excellent. Those are people that I can relate to, and I know a lot of our listeners do as well. Let me ask you, I know you like church history, historical theology. Many of Christianity's great theologians were also great philosophers. Is there somebody in the past that really makes you think, has influenced you? Who would be maybe your favorite Christian thinker outside of the New Testament?
Yes, my favorite Christian thinker would be Thomas Aquinas, followed by Augustine. But I studied philosophy at St. Louis University. Eleanor Stump, a very well-known Thomistic scholar, teaches there. And I took a number of courses from there, and I became very attracted to the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas because I like the way that he integrates philosophy and theology. He does that very well. But previous to St. Louis University, I earned an MA in theology from Fuller Theological Seminary. So I was wanting to do the same thing. I wanted to integrate my philosophy with my theology. So I was at St. Louis University studying philosophy, and I just enjoyed reading the Summa Theologiae that Aquinas wrote and the Summa Contra Gentiles and some of his other works.
Yeah, Thomas is encyclopedic. I often say, in fact, I say in my little book, Classic Christian Thinkers, that I think Thomas probably exemplified the golden rule of apologetics. He seems to consider almost every conceivable objection to his view, even before he presents it. So he is a remarkable Christian thinker. Well, let me ask you just a couple more questions, and then I want Joe to ask a bit about a blog article that you've written. Well, being a philosopher who is interested in science and also interested in theology, Miguel, I like to often ask our guests, is there an argument or a piece of evidence that really weighs heavily in favor of the existence of God and the truth of Christianity? I know you could probably mention a lot of things, but is there anything that really hits you as something that's quite probative in favor of God and Christ?
Yes, I think so. When I wrote my dissertation, it was on natural law theory, Thomas Aquinas' natural law theory. And according to the natural law theory, God has made us in such a way that we are naturally prone to discover certain basic truths about morality. This goes along with what the Apostle Paul says in Romans 2, 14 through 16. So I became very interested in that because previous to that, I studied the moral theory of Kant, and it just didn't satisfy it. It bothered me studying it. I couldn't make sense of it because Kant, Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, detaches morality from happiness and morality from well-being. Morality is something that you have to do because you discover what the moral law is, and that weighs upon your conscience, and you have to follow through on that. But that didn't sit right with me. Aquinas gives us a more natural understanding of it. So what I've done since I've graduated from St. Louis University is I've written articles where I talk about morality, but I try to, I'm an apologist, so I'm explaining morality from the natural law perspective. That is, I try to find evidence really outside of theology for the truth of God's word in regarding issues on ethics and morality. So I enjoy natural law arguments. Those are my favorite.
Well, let's talk about a couple articles. I know some time back you published what I thought was a very engaging and fascinating article. You talked about sexuality, particularly in our common culture, but you did it within the context of some of the writing of my favorite Christian thinker, St. Augustine. Tell us a little bit, outline that article. What did you do in that piece?
Yes. Well, from the beginning, during the pandemic, I had a lot of time on my hands. Yeah. My classes were online, so I had more time. And I decided to start reading something I always wanted to read, but felt it was too daunting of a task. I started reading The City of God.
Wow.
It's not a light read, but I decided if I'm ever going to do it, I'll do it now. And I noticed that book 14 of City of God talks about sexual morality. And I think that Augustine does a beautiful job of explaining sexual morality. He gives us a holistic picture. So I decided to write the article. The way that I dig deeper into subject matters that I like is by writing articles on them. What else would you like me to say about that?
Well, let me just bring our listeners up to speed. We're talking about a two-part blog article that Dr. Miguel Andara has written for the Voices area of our website. As our listeners know, we have our regular scholars who write their blog posts. Ken does one as well. But we also have our visiting scholars. They write in an area of our site called Voices. Those are featured biweekly. So we have two of Miguel's articles. It's part one and two, Augustine's Sexual Ethic, part one, part two, published here on our RTB website just a few weeks ago. So that lets you know where they are and what we're talking about here.
If I may say something more about that, I based the two blog posts on a article that I wrote for the National Catholic Bioethics Quarterly that was published in winter of 2020, which is called Augustine on Sex and the Neurochemistry of Attachment. That's where the blog posts come from.
Yeah, I know I'd like to hear more about the what is it called again? The
Neurochemistry of Attachment.
Neurochemistry of Attachment. Yes. In just a moment, but first maybe we can set up the tension, if you will. If I recall from your article, and I helped to edit it, so I recall a little bit, you set it up very nicely by kind of pitting the contemporary scenario against Christian morality, Christian sexual mores, and you even cited a scholar, Elaine Pagels, and people like her. It's like Christianity is so yesterday, you know, repressive, oppressive. They just can't get anything right, let alone sexual mores. So you can set it up better than I can, but maybe you can talk about, you know, that part of the article and then go from there.
Yes, of course. Well, as we all know, as we all recognize, the culture is not in favor of sexual mores. The culture is against it. And yes, as you were saying, Joe, yeah, the people or the culture, popular culture will tell us that if we follow the Christian ethics, yes, we are repressing ourselves. And this doesn't just come from Elaine Pagels, a well-known popular scholar, but most people in society, most people who have a voice in society would say the same thing. It all began, I think, with Sigmund Freud, who started saying things like that. As an apologist, that's my calling. That's what I do. As an apologist, I wanted to respond to that challenge. Is it true that Christian mores no longer should hold sway? They don't hold much sway, but should they hold sway? Is it true that we're repressing ourselves if we adopt the Christian moral ethical standard? Is what Sigmund Freud, Elaine Pagels, and others say, is that true? And do we become happy and fulfilled and joyous by expressing ourselves in any way we want sexually?
You know, what's interesting, Miguel, I wonder if you could speak to this topic. There's a lot of discussion these days about the topic of pornography. I mean, the web and all of the electronic places, you can access what we call pornography. I have read that experts in the brain say that observing, watching pornography has an effect upon the brain, effect upon the mind. What's your thinking about that? What's the problem there? Why would that be harmful?
Well, yes. Thank you for that question, Ken Deggles. That takes us back to the way I defend the Christian moral standards, and that is by talking about the neurochemistry of attachment. When it comes to pornography, people are addicted to pornography because of different chemicals that are released when they're watching pornography. I'm no expert on this issue. I have studied and I have written about it, but these neurochemicals that are released change us anatomically and also in a pathological way. People who are addicted to pornography exhibit certain characteristics such as impulsivity, compulsivity, emotional disunity, and impaired judgment. Why? Because pornography addiction severely damages our capacity for pair bonding. The idea is that when people engage in sexual activity or when people start viewing pornography, certain hormones are released. And these hormones become damaged if we detach the viewing of pornography, if we get addicted to pornography, as opposed to us having a monogamous sexual relationship with our spouse. When we have monogamous marital relationship with our spouse, certain neurochemicals such as oxytocin and vasopressin, oxytocin mainly in women, vasopressin mainly in men, these hormones attach us emotionally, existentially, to our spouse, and they have us have greater, they promote trust and love towards our spouse. The problem is that if we engage in casual sexual relationships, and again, this is also connected to pornography, but if we engage in casual sexual relationships, these hormones will not function as well as they're supposed to function. One of the authors that I read likened the weakening of the function of these hormones to duct tape. You could use duct tape to tape two things together, but what happens if you rip out the duct tape and tape it on two other things, and then rip it out and tape it on two other things, and so on and so forth? Eventually the duct tape will not function that well. And so it is with vasopressin and oxytocin. Short-term sexual relationships, we are told, that have little connectedness or intimacy, in other words, damage the physiological mechanism that the body has for bonding. How is that, or why is that? And neurochemists tell us that the neurochemical imprint of past sexual relationships remain, disrupting or preventing the physiological process that leads to healthy relationships. So when we start looking at pornography and get addicted to it, when we start engaging in sexual, many sexual liaisons, we damage his capacity, we damage his ability, and the hormone then that vasopressin and oxytocin don't work as well, but other hormones remain, other hormones that make us feel good. So we chase after the feeling we have when we engage in sexual relationships, and we leave behind the intimacy that's supposed to be connected with that. So what ends up happening is it is difficult for those people who have had many sexual liaisons to enter into deep and abiding marriages. It's very, very hard for them. And we also see this in the statistics. People who have had many sexual partners have a lower percentage of staying married, right? And they have multiple marriages because the hormone doesn't work as well. And it actually works against being intimately involved and having a strong bond with another person. So, and in doing that, well, what happens? Well, there are many psychological pathologies that follow, such as depression and other things similar to that. And also, God created us, I believe, to have bonds, strong bonds with others, especially with our spouse. And if God meant us to get married and we are to have a strong bond with our spouse, but we can no longer do this, then we have we lack something. We have a certain emptiness, a certain dissatisfaction with ourselves. And so these are some of the issues, some of the problems that come up when we disregard God's moral ethical law.
Yeah. Miguel, I have a question. In your two-part article that we're talking about, Augustine's Sexual Ethic, Parts 1 and 2, by Miguel and Dara, here at the RTB website, you mentioned three goods of marriage that Augustine describes: fidelity, procreation, and sacrament. Tell us, give us a little bit more on that, and why Augustine seems to speak to today, even though he lived, you know, back in the 5th century and wrote back then.
Thank you, Joe. That's exactly what I was getting at. I wanted to show that maybe these church fathers still have something to say to us, and Augustine still has something to say to us. So the way Augustine explains his theology of sex is that first and foremost, we have to have a rightly ordered will. The human will needs to have first and foremost as its end, as its goal, God, the love of God. And if we do that, if the most important thing in our life is to follow God and please God, then our whole being will be rightly aligned. Or the way Augustine explains it is that we have many desires, desires and emotional attachment, many loves. And we have to rightly order these loves, putting God first and putting everything else, or loving everything else, in relation to God. And so it is with our desire to express ourselves sexually. First is God, right? And we have to order these desires in accord with our love for God. And one of the things that God is pleased that we do, I know he doesn't call everybody to marriage, but for those people to whom he calls to be married, we are to bind with our spouse. So our rightly ordered love should be right regarding sex, should be towards our spouse. And so we ought to attain unity with our spouse. And the way we attain unity for Augustine is through fidelity, right? Sexual fidelity, through procreation. According to statistics, people who have children inside of marriage, people who have children bind in a stronger manner than those people who have children outside of marriage. So that's an example of what I'm talking about. And I think that goes along with what Augustine says. So fidelity, procreation, and what Augustine calls sacrament. Now, what Augustine means by that is that Augustine recognizes that marriage is for life. And that he likens that, the idea of the marriage for life, to the love that God has for us. God's love is for us is everlasting. It's always there. So marriage has that feature, and you could say that analogous feature, that to the way God sees us. So these are the three things, right? So fidelity, procreation, and what we may call permanence, permanence in marriage. And if we do that, if we have these three parts of marriage, this proper ordering, then marriage will bring about great satisfaction in our life. Maybe it'll bring about more satisfaction in our lives than almost anything else apart from loving God.
Interesting.
Yeah. What I think is interesting, Miguel, is, you know, having grown up in the 1960s and 70s, lots of people talked about sexual liberation, open marriage, all kinds of ideas, but the great irony is that they have less contentment, you know, there really isn't, I mean, it's a scary thing, I think, to engage in pornography that would then damage your relationship with your spouse or prevent you from developing greater intimacy. I remember I had a friend in high school who was a very fine athlete, handsome guy, had lots of sexual relationships. And I remember him coming to me one day and saying, you know, I don't get anything out of sex. I wonder, am I a homosexual? Because I don't feel satisfied. I don't feel fulfilled. So here is that liberation, and the fruit of it is very sour. So I appreciate not only you writing about these issues that are so relevant to our contemporary world, but I really appreciate that you've mined out of Augustine and others these really important ideas. I'm beginning to think the St. Augustine guy has a lot to say. So,
amen.
Lots of words. I especially appreciated your comment about marriage being the closest thing to heaven. I always liked some statement someone made that a good marriage is probably the closest thing to our relationship with God and heaven on earth, while a bad marriage is the closest thing to hell on earth.
Hmm. Wow. If I may comment on that, aren't there a few scriptures, including Revelation 20, that talk about the marriage of the Lamb?
Hmm.
So there's an analogy there, right? Between a harmonious marriage here on earth and then the marriage of the Lamb. Of course, the greater love between the Lamb and his bride than between spouses here on earth. But nevertheless, John, one who wrote Revelation, the book of Revelation, he sees this analogy, right, in his vision.
That's right.
It's a beautiful analogy. So the closest, the best way we could understand the love that God has for us is by viewing or understanding a harmonious Christian marriage.
Mm. Miguel, I wonder if you might tie a knot for me and anybody else who is listening and just would like to make sure they're tracking. And Ken, maybe you can weigh in on this as well, because we're talking about creation, after all, how God intended things to be at the very beginning, marriage between a man and a woman. Miguel, are you saying that modern science, in this case, the neurochemistry of attachment, affirms what Augustine said, and insofar as Augustine reflects the biblical view of marriage, we need to pay heed to the science because it's consistent with the scriptures? Maybe you can kind of tie all this up for those of us who are tracking, but just want to hear it from you.
Yes, of course, Joe. What you say is exactly right. The Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, is not a manual of ethics. No, there are different things that different authors say at different times regarding different moral topics, including sex. But there's no place in the Bible where we see a whole treatise on biblical ethics. We have parts here and parts there. But what Augustine does is that he takes all these ideas from the from the Bible, and he puts them together in a coherent manner, in a manner that makes sense. And then he explains and he connects that to, like you say, Joe, to creation. He begins with Adam and Eve, and he begins with the sin of Adam and Eve before he starts talking about sex. So he connects everything together in a way that makes sense. And so that's the reason that I use Augustine.
Miguel, let me talk a little bit more about a very critical theme in St. Augustine. It's picked up later by Thomas Aquinas as well. But Augustine talks a lot about, as you alluded to, disordered loves, that even though we're created in the image of God, we are now fallen creatures. And fallen creatures have a tendency to shift their focus away from God to temporal issues. And, you know, it's not only common in Augustine's day, but in our day, that people maybe they transfer their worship from God to sex, to money, to achievement. Augustine's life was filled with ambition before he became a Christian or returned to his Christianity. And so he speaks, I think, very authoritatively. But here's my question for you. It seems to me, in light of reading Augustine, light of reading scripture, that people in a fallen condition, they don't look to necessarily bad things. I mean, sex is a good thing. Money's a good thing. I like having money to pay my grocery bill. Achievement is a good thing. Even Lucifer, in Augustine's mind, didn't choose a bad thing. He chose himself. So certain level of egoism is not bad. But it seems to me, and I wonder if you agree, that people try to get out of sex, money, and achievement, these good things that they should be getting from God. That is, they're looking at temporal things to give them kind of an eternal reward. And as good as those temporal things are, they can't satisfy us existentially. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're exactly right, Ken. Augustine does talk about that when he talks about having properly ordered loves, properly ordered attachments, emotional attachments, desires. He calls this the ordo amoris, properly ordered love. And the idea is, again, God is first and you love everything else, or you seek after everything else in relation, in proper relation to God. And this, not only does Augustine talk about this, but there's something similar in Aquinas. Aquinas says that everything that we seek after because there is some good in it. But the problem is that even though there's some good in it, maybe there's a greater amount of evil in those things that we seek after, especially if we seek after them for themselves. I mean, so I think they are saying similar things, doing a different way. So God first and everything else in relation to God. If we do that, if we order, according to Augustine, our will properly, right? We have free will. And if we order our will properly, if we align our will in accord with the ordo amoris, then we achieve satisfaction. So yeah, when it comes to power, when it comes to sex and fame and riches, yes, all these things, they're not bad in and of themselves, as you correctly said, Ken. But if we seek after them as if they were God, right, then they become idols for us. Idols that, according to Augustine, destroy us eventually. These things, the desire for these things, the lust for these things enter into our soul. They are, as I've heard you say before, Ken, they are like a parasite. Yeah. Right? They feed off the host. The parasites feed off their host. Well, these sins, these disordered loves feed off the host of our soul, and they begin to slowly destroy us from within. We are created, again, as you properly said, Ken, we are created for God, right? That's the first book of Augustine's Confession. And we will be restless until we find unity with God. So these things will never, never satisfy.
I have another question for either Miguel or Ken. Both of you can respond. A lot of people have made a mess of their lives, including Augustine, in this area of sexuality. I wonder if there's some people who are wondering, you know what, I have had multiple partners, and now I'm a Christian. You know, is there any hope for me to overcome the struggles that I have? Is there any science there, or would you offer any pastoral advice? I know I'm putting you on the spot, but there could be people who are just wondering, you know, I've really made a mess of things. How do I make it right?
Your question, Joe, is more pastoral and theological. I haven't found or I haven't looked for science to say how much we could be restored after we make a mess out of our lives. Mm-hmm. But God, our God, is a God of grace and a God of love. And what he loves to do is redeem us, redeem sinners, and make us whole again, make us whole. God's love, God's grace could trump the internal disorder that we may have because of the way we've lived our lives. However, we may need some therapy, right? I'm not saying that we should do away with therapy. Yes, God works in different people in different ways. Yeah, might need a little therapy, we might need a lot of therapy, or from one day to the next, God might heal us completely. That's up to God and the way God chooses to work with us. But God's love is big enough where he could, if we repent of our sin, he could forgive us and he could restore us, make us whole.
And I, Joe, I think you see that. I mean, I've had many people ask me what I find attractive about Augustine's Confessions. And I think what I think is when Augustine writes, I think he's talking about me. He's talking about the universal human condition. And Augustine says those very things, that he made a wreck of his life, that he had illicit sexual relationships. He had a common law marriage, and they had a child together. But Augustine also is the great church father of grace, that God's grace comes to us in the love of God, the forgiveness of Christ. And so the wonderful answer is, as much as you may have sinned, God can forgive you, God can restore you, God can transform your life. And he certainly did that to Augustine and Paul, and so many of us can say that. Miguel, I wonder if I could ask you another question. This is again referencing Augustine and Aquinas, but on a little bit of a different topic. It seems to me that evangelical Protestants don't always appreciate or don't see the value in kind of mining these great truths from the church fathers or St. Augustine. Some people, for example, would say, well, Ken, you talk about Augustine and Aquinas, are you a Catholic? How have you worked through that? You have an evangelical point of view, but you've studied these great Catholics. How would you respond to somebody who is not quite sure that reading Augustine or Aquinas is a good thing?
Okay. Well, Aquinas says that all truth is God's truth. Mm-hmm. So I go with that. I look at the church fathers and whether the Catholic Church has adopted them as their own or not, it doesn't matter. What do the church fathers say? What can help us live a godly Christian life today. So I do recognize that when it comes to Aquinas, especially Aquinas, yes, many Protestants don't like him because he's associated with the Catholic Church, right? Because, when it comes to Augustine, of course, Luther adopted Augustine as the way I understand it, the main church father, the main theologian. And so Augustine is a little bit more accepted in Protestant circles. But I don't let these distinctions bother me too much. I try to focus on what I think to be the truth. And how do I know what the truth is? Well, by God's grace, I study God's word and try to make sense of it and see how these different church fathers line up. And I find that these church fathers have taught me a great deal.
Yeah. Well, I heartily agree. Miguel, I'd like to ask you another question. I have a recent book entitled Christianity Cross-Examined. And one of the things that I communicate in my latest book is that it seems to me, if I go back to when I first started doing apologetics with Walter Martin and John Warwick Montgomery back in the mid to late 80s, when I would go to the university, students would principally ask me truth questions. Does God exist? Is Jesus the Son of God? Was he raised from the dead? However, moving forward to RTB, about 10 or 15 years ago, I noticed kind of a change when I would go with Hugh and Fuzz and Jeff or Dave to a college campus. I noticed that the students started asking me less truth questions, although I still got them, but they would often ask whether Christianity had been a good thing. Has it been good for racial minorities? Doesn't the sexual mores, you know, lead to hangups for people? Have you noticed that yourself, that we seem to be, I guess in philosophical language, moving from kind of modernism of truth questions to postmodern questions about goodness? Has that been your experience?
I think that's exactly right, Ken. I have noticed that when I teach classes in secular colleges and universities, the people are just not as interested, at least young people, in the truth. They're interested in other things. And just last week, I was teaching a class at a secular institution on Richard Rorty. He's a very well-known, very popular postmodernist philosopher. And he's telling us that science, I know RTB has great respect for science, but he's telling us that science should not be put on a pedestal. Science is the same as any other discipline because we cannot access the truth. Science doesn't give us more truth than, let's say, sociology or psychology or anything else. Truth is inaccessible. We can't get to it for whatever reason. So what he says is that our epistemology, our understanding of knowledge, or our ways of gaining knowledge should change. They should not be so much scientific. Instead, they should focus on, of all things, solidarity. They should focus on having unity of thought, unity of feeling with other people. That's what's important. Let's focus on that. And I think that Richard Rorty, though he's deceased now, and his writings are very, very popular still today. And I think that many people have adopted that way of thinking. And even if they don't recognize the name, his thoughts have trickled down from the university to the popular culture. Yes, what's important is unity with others of thought, unity of feeling, solidarity, and these other things about the truth. Well, who cares about the truth? It's not the ultimate thing that matters.
I appreciate that, Miguel. It makes me think, you know, for some people, one of the ancient criticisms of philosophy was the accusation that it didn't bake any bread. But what I have discovered is a lot of these postmodern ideas have been at the university for a long time, but they do kind of drip down into culture. And it reminds me how important it is to be able to think carefully, to think critically. It reminds me of what my philosophy professors taught me, of understanding ideas, and that ideas have critical value. I guess my question for you is, if you, as you look at culture, you know, we've gone through this pandemic, American culture and other cultures around the world have experienced a lot of pain and difficulty because of this this pandemic. I guess the question I want to ask you is, what in your mind is one of the major criticisms or major issues confronting Christianity? I mean, what is it that keeps people away from maybe embracing the truth of Christianity in your mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'd have to go back to Rory, because people today, they don't, as you say, they don't care so much about truth, but about feeling good about themselves, feeling good about other people. They abstain from any type of moral judgment, and just try to live these kind of lives where truth and reality don't matter. What matter is social relationships. Everything the postmodern people say is a social construct, right? Societies get together, groups of people get together, and they create or invent what they consider to be real or true or good. So I think that's the malady that afflicts our society today: less respect for the truth and a greater amount of going towards commonality and feeling.
C.S. Lewis made the comment a number of times, the idea that the mind is the organ of truth and rationality, while the imagination is the organ of a meaning. Is there any relationship between that viewpoint that he's expressing there and this sort of contrast that we're experiencing and discussing here today? In other words, is Rorty sort of focusing more on the imagination and the meaning of things rather than whether they're true or not?
It would seem that way. Yeah. Yes. I think that people are more concerned, to put it metaphorically, with the heart than with the head, right? And I think Lewis makes those types of distinctions as well. What matters ultimately is feeling, emotion,
right,
and not truth itself. But as I pointed out to my students, well, I got this from reading another philosopher, but Richard Rorty says, yeah, what's important is solidarity. But how about when you go to, when you go somewhere and you need the GPS to give you directions, you go into another country or someplace that you've never been before, doesn't that give us the truth? So isn't there truth to be had, truth to be discovered? Because you can't say that we base our, or it doesn't make sense to say that we should base our GPS or our maps on solidarity. That makes no sense whatsoever. Think of building a bridge. Yes, we should use the epistemology of solidarity to build a bridge. No, we should use the truth of science and engineering, mathematics, to build the bridge. Otherwise, good luck.
Yeah. Very true.
Miguel, it seems to me that the prism by which ancient Christians, medieval Christians thought through were the transcendentals, truth, goodness, and beauty. Whereas today, I think in large measure, many people think about race, gender, and class rather than truth, goodness, and beauty. I guess my question here is, do you think that, I have some friends who are secular. If I invite them to church, they will tell me, no, not interested. If I invite them to an art museum, they're all over it. Is it possible that we could use, as you do, by the way, you you talk about goodness and you bring them back to the truth. Is it possible that we could maybe use things like beauty and kind of circle back to truth and goodness? What are your thoughts about that topic?
Yes, I do agree. And this is what I do when I teach at secular institutions. Well, first, I pray every day for my students, and I ask the Lord to help, to use me to open up their minds to the truth of God's reality when they hear it. So maybe what I'm doing is pre-apologetics when I teach in secular institutions, or pre-evangelism, I should say. And so how do I do that? Well, I make sure they get a healthy dose of Plato and Aristotle. As we may recognize, Plato influenced Augustine heavily, and Aristotle influenced Aquinas heavily. Why? They didn't have the whole truth, but they were right. They were correct in many, many things. And that's the beauty of studying these ancient philosophers. So yes, so I introduce Socrates, the character of Socrates. And what was Socrates' main concern in life? To seek after truth and goodness and beauty. And he went against the whole of Athens, right? He went around Athens, he asked people questions, and he went against them when they said that, no, what's important are other things, such as fame and power, money. So these are, I like to begin with Plato and then Aristotle, because these philosophers, I think they begin to get us on the right path towards truth and goodness and beauty. And the contrast that we see in Platonic dialogues, for example, where Socrates is dialoguing with the people of Athens, the beautiful, beautiful contrast, I think, that highlights the importance of truth, goodness, and beauty. We see these in the Republic, for example, the book that Plato wrote, the Republic. We see these puffed up politicians thinking that because they know a lot about the law and they know how to sway people's opinions, they know about all things, right? And Socrates just shows them up. He shows that's not true, that they are not wise. They're only wise in their own eyes. So we see these kind of things, and I teach my students this as I pray to the Lord that he would open up the rise to the truth. And I'll just give one more example, if I may. Aristotle, I love to teach the Nicomachean Ethics, his treatise on ethics, on virtue ethics. Aristotle goes directly against the ideas that wealth and pleasure and wealth and pleasure and fame and these kind of things are going to make us happy. And I love his example. I'll just give you one example. When Aristotle talks about why pleasure isn't what we human beings should seek after, he says, we're not cows. If we were cows, okay, maybe pleasure is the highest good for us. We are human beings. We are rational beings. Pleasure may satisfy for a short while, but that's not the ultimate goal. And he aligns the ultimate goal with rational ideals, right? With wisdom and other virtues. But again, these ancient philosophers give us a beautiful start on the path of truth and goodness and beauty that we could connect the way that Augustine and Aquinas have connected in the past to God's truth. As Aquinas likes to say, grace perfects nature. Plato and Aristotle, they could only get so far when it came to the truth. But when you have Augustine and Aquinas, well, the grace of God perfects what began with these ancient philosophers. And we could have a more complete story of truth and happiness and beauty.
I think it's interesting that while people have criticized maybe Augustine for adopting Platonic or Neoplatonic ideas, and certainly Aquinas has been criticized for his Aristotelian Christian synthesis, it seems to me, Miguel, that more and more today, Plato and Aristotle are allies to the Christian faith in this, especially in this time of kind of sophistry of subjectivism and postmodernism. Joe, as we move to close our interview with Miguel today, I wonder if you can tell everybody how to get a hold of his articles. And Miguel, is there a place that people might find out more information about you if they're interested?
Well, through our Reasons to Believe. Reasons to Believe is currently setting up a page with my name on it, with the articles I've written and with other information about me.
Yeah, there'll be a scholar bio. We already have one. So if you look up, look for Voices. If you go to our website, reasons.org, you'll see the various blogs. Our scholars have their own blogs. And then the channel called Voices, if you click through on that one, you'll find Miguel's two articles, Augustine's Sexual Ethic, Parts 1 and 2. And then you can click through on his name, which takes you to his bio. I just want to say, contrary to what you just said, Miguel, I've had a lot of pleasure listening to this program, Two Philosophers Here. Well, I'm kidding. Of course, my mind has been enjoying it, but it's not like I'm eating grass like a cow, but there's something pleasurable about hearing these ideas and how they resonate with the Christian faith. So thank you for that. I just wanted to ask one more thing. You mentioned that you're teaching. I think people might want to know how that's going, where you're teaching, what you're teaching, and so on.
Well, I'm teaching at the Veritas International University, a Christian university, which though it is Protestant, it's Thomistic also. A unique privilege of teaching there. And I teach also at other institutions.
Wonderful. Well, keep up the good work. All right. I think that's going to wrap it up. Unless Ken or Dave, you have anything more, we'll...
Want to say, Miguel, it's a pleasure not only to have you as a visiting scholar. I appreciate your passion for philosophy and particularly for Augustine and Aquinas, but it's been a real pleasure to have you on Straight Thinking today. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Ken. My pleasure has been mine. And thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Dave.
Nice to meet another JP, at least a past JPLer.
There you go.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to wrap it up for this podcast. Don't miss any episodes of Straight Thinking. You can subscribe to the Reasons to Believe podcast on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts, and you'll get an episode delivered to you each week. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogsad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.